for asking me to speak tonight. And just so everybody knows, I've never spoke before. This is new, so hopefully I can do this. I'd like to thank everybody for coming. If you're new here, give it a chance. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous was the last place I wanted to end up, and today I'm very, very grateful to be here. Thank you for all my friends that came to see me and support me. I appreciate it. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous has always been about. You guys are awesome. Thank you. I'd like to thank Ian for coming, my son. you know, for me, how it was, early on in my childhood, I grew up with alcoholism. Didn't make me an alcoholic, but it's riddled in my family. Grandparents, parents, both sides, aunts, uncles. There are five of us kids. Four of us are alcoholics. One's scared to death and doesn't drink. And when she does drink, she gets a little carried away. You know, I had an older brother that was a year and a half, to be exact, older than me. So in our family, it went the oldest sibling who got that attention for being the oldest sibling. Then it was the smartest sibling who got the attention for being the smartest sibling, and they were both girls. Then a brother who worked his rear off on the ranch, and me. I was the youngest child. And so for a long time, being the youngest child, you can get away with murder. And then 8 years that sunlight and sunshine was taken from me, there was a sibling that came after me. And he stole my parade. He rained on my parade. And I actually tried to get rid of him and got caught. And I tried to suffocate him with a pillow, and I remember doing it. My mom came in, and I told her I was adjusting the pillow. He needed to go, and he needed to go quickly. I was never left alone again with him, which is just fine. I'm going to end up knocking over this table. you know, my older brother, that was a year and a half, was full of mischief, and I followed right in tail with him. My parents would have very, very elaborate parties, and there'd be lots of mixed drinks around, and my older brother would insist that I follow him around and help him drink these drinks. And I always ended up sick, and I didn't know why. At that time, I was too young to know what the actual alcohol was doing. It didn't make me feel good. I just ended up sick. I didn't realize what alcohol could do for me for my freshman year in high school. It was the first weekend my freshman year. My brother was a junior, and him and his friends went in one car. We were told by my brother we were to follow him in another car to a dance after a football game, and we did so. He handed all us girls bottles of alcohol, told us to go in the bathroom, down them, and come out and dance with his friends, and we did. And all of us got sick, and all of us loved it. And we followed him along all through high school like that. It was him and his friends and me and my friends, and we were quite a posse. There were probably 40 teenagers in our neighborhood. And every Friday and Saturday night, they either ended up in our front yard or our backyard, which was fine with my father because he could keep tabs on us kids. And that's what my brother and I were always drinking buddies. So my dad knew we would be drinking together, and my dad kind of wanted to keep tabs on us that way. So we did that. You know, I noticed in high school that when I was drinking, something usually happens as a consequence to my drinking. One year, a bunch of us girls went up to, we had a cabin, and we went up to Wilsonia, and we had a lot to drink, and we thought it would be a great idea, and we went and sold horses from a horse corral up in Grants Grove. And one of my girlfriends ended up being hurt, and the horse I was on, because I was drinking too much, trampled over the top of her. And we had to make up elaborate stories, and my parents had to bring us down from the mountains because she was hurt. My brother and I, we had a ranch. I don't know where I am in this building. And when we had too much to drink, we were afraid we were going to get caught by our parents. We'd go out to that ranch and drink, and we usually ended up in trouble out there. Somebody usually ended up hurt or very, very sick. And I would like to say that we had a blast. It was the best time of my life. I would never trade it for the life of me. It's just a very, very good. I had wonderful siblings. We all loved each other to death. We all beat the hell out of each other our whole life, but we all love each other to death. And that was really important. I knew that my drinking was really, a really, really big problem when I went away to college and nobody drank like I did. And people started saying things to me about my drinking. People would say that I needed to slow down, and I didn't know what that meant. Where we came from, we were big funnelers. We liked the funnel, put the beer, all the beer in the bong and drink it at once. And we would have contests with time watches, stopwatches. And when we went away to college, people didn't do that. They thought we were kind of weird, my brother and I. And when I went away to college was when I started blackout drinking, because I started, instead of drinking straight beer, we started mixing things in college. And, at parties, people had open bars. And so I soon learned what a blackout was. At that point, I also was going places with people I probably shouldn't be going with, doing things I probably shouldn't be doing. And at that point, I really had no business drinking. People would say that I drink like an alcoholic, and I knew that, but I thought it didn't bother me for some reason that they would say that, really. I think deep down it bothered me, but on the outside I wasn't going to let you know that it bothered me. And so I continued to drink that way. It was a very, very scary time in my life. My brother's wife now, who lives in Lemoore, we used to do what we called rail driving, and she usually did the driving because if someone was going to get busted, I wanted her to. And she would drive with her, because I was right-eye dominated, and we'd both hold onto the steering wheel, and we'd drive, and we would laugh, and we still giggle about it this day. Neither one of us drinks this day, but we would do rail driving, which was very, very dangerous, and I started taking a lot of risks when I was away at college because, the heat was off me. I was at home. My parents couldn't manage my drinking. I could manage my drinking. I started having to manage my classes around my drinking. So I took classes only on Tuesday and Thursdays because I could drink the rest of the week, and I'd have the whole weekend. And, most people were studying on Sunday night, but I still got to drink Sunday night because Monday I didn't have classes. So then usually if I drank Monday night, I wouldn't end up going to Tuesday classes. And but finally ended up, my first quarter away at school, I had a great GPA, and I got called in by this man, and he was my counselor. I didn't know who he was. And he asked me if I had a drinking problem. I'd never met the man in my life, and I thought, do I have a drinking problem? And I thought, well, how would he know whether or not I have a drinking problem? And he said, most people that come to this college, if they can't get it together and their GPAs drop, they have a drinking problem. And I thought, oh, shit, the heat is on. So I thought, well, I better make excuses and start getting to class. And I did. I pulled up my GPA just a little bit, and just enough to get me out of the heat and out of that guy's office. And what ended up happening was my mother was in a fire, and she was very badly burned. And I wasn't doing so well in school. And I was going to get busted, and my dad was going to yank me home anyway. So I made up the excuse that my mom was too sick for me to stay away long enough. And so I didn't continue my education, which was a huge waste now that I look back at it, but that was what happened at that time. And so what I did was I stayed home, and I partied with my friends, and I met my drinking buddy. And after 3 years, I married my drinking buddy because my mom was sick and tired of me not being home. I stayed home to take care of her, and she was sick and tired because I wasn't taking care of her, and I was too busy out drinking. So I married my drinking buddy, and it was a lot of fun. Had a lot of fun. Then nobody could really manage me. I could manage myself, and that was really important to me. I thought that I was a grown-up because I could drink when I wanted to drink, how I wanted to drink, and I drank like a pig. And I managed to learn that if I only drank beer, I'd pretty much stay out of a blackout. I started drinking, and I knew that there was not, I had to start drinking before we went to parties because there was not going to be enough alcohol at the party for me. I don't know if anybody drank like that. I had to, I was one of those people that had to stay the last one at the party. When they were dying for everybody to leave, I was still there. I was a midnight caller. I would get on a dial at midnight. My siblings got tired and stopped answering the phone. And I knew my life was out of control because I was a great employee if you could get me there. If you could get me there and keep me there, I was really good at what I did. The problem was that I still drank like as if I was at college and I only needed to be working on Tuesday and Thursday. The rest of the week, you could hardly get me there. And I thought since I was an adult that it didn't matter that you couldn't get me to work. You know, I didn't think people would actually fire me, and they did. So what I did to get the heat off, because my husband was getting a little bit upset with my drinking, was I decided that if I had children, I'd quit drinking. If I had children, I'm sure I'd slow down. So I got pregnant and, of course, immediately quit drinking, and I thought, well, I couldn't be an alcoholic because I could quit drinking. How can I be an alcoholic if I can quit drinking just like that as soon as I found out I was pregnant? So obviously I wasn't. And I was really thankful for that. There was this, like, oh, thank God, you know, I'm not like my dad, you know, who could never. And so I had my first child, and I could hardly wait till he was on the bottle so I could start drinking again, because you couldn't drink and nurse and et cetera, et cetera. And so my first experience back with my alcoholism was my son was 2 weeks old, and it was my 10th class reunion. And my best friend from high school was going to take care of Ian for me, and I knew I wouldn't drink because I was still nursing, so I knew I wouldn't drink, and I knew I was cool, I could go. And so on I went to the class reunion, and about 4 o'clock in the morning, she finally got a hold of me, because I told her I'd be there by 10, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, we showed up to take care of my son, and she, thank God, had gone to the store and gotten bottles for him, because I didn't drop off bottles. Why would I drop off bottles? She wouldn't need them. I was going to be there. I knew I was going to be back. And her husband, she was leaving for Saugus to go on a Christmas trip of some sort, or she was going to do something for Christmas shopping at that point. And so her husband was really upset because he'd had to listen to Ian cry for 2 hours while she had left with her mom. And so I was really apologetic to her, and the drinking was back on until I got pregnant again. And with my second child, I knew the cycle, and I knew the trouble that I was in. And so I thought, well, I won't, since I know the cycle, I know that I won't drink after I have my daughter. I'll just, no drinking whatsoever, and I know I can quit now. I'll just stop, and I won't drink anymore. And I was 8.5 months pregnant with her, and we were on a train from, I tell you, to Fresno to the spaghetti factory. And my sister walked past me, and she said, well, you know, the doctor told you could have one drink. She goes, well, let's go have a drink. So I thought, okay, 8.5 months pregnant, I'll just have one drink. So I go down to the bar cart where everybody is having a blast, and, you know, I'm kind of a little pissed off because everybody's drinking and I can't drink. So I go down to the bar cart, and I'm looking, and I said, well, what's the biggest drink? And my sister's looking at me, and she's like, what do you mean, what's the biggest drink? Well, I thought if I could have one drink, I'd eat the biggest one. So needless to say, she ordered me a wine spritzer, kind of little, stupid little 7-Up with a dash of wine. And I went back to the car with her, and I drank it. And I don't know how to explain the feeling that I had, but to say that there was a beast inside of me. I didn't know what I had done. I didn't know enough about alcoholism to know that I had awakened that beast. And I made every single person on that train miserable. I made every single person at the spaghetti factory miserable. And I went to sneak back to the cart to get one more drink. I wanted one more of the big ones. And I'm standing there ordering, and all of a sudden the chill just goes down the back of my spine, and both my sisters are standing behind me, busting me. And I'm like, well, I didn't order it with wine. And of course the man that's serving me said, well, yeah, you did. And so it was a long trip. It was a very long trip back to Visalia. It was horrendous, and I was really scared at that point because of the feeling that internal feeling that had given me as far as being 8.5 months pregnant, and to me not caring about what I was carrying inside of me, and so that scared me. About 3 or 4 years later, my disease progressed. I started having jobs, and when I couldn't make it to work, I'd always quit before they were just about ready to fire me. I always knew when the heat was on, you know, when people would have calendars out and you'd see the big X's the days I wasn't there. And so I knew that I would need to quit. So I was kind of a job hopper, but I was still really good at when I got there. I was really good at my job when I got there. I was really proud of that fact. I drank like a pig, and I did this thing that I know now what it is where I worked, our big thing was we would go to Lum Lum's for a happy hour, and a group of us gals would go. And my husband would say on Friday night, why don't I take you and come back and pick you up? And I would say every Friday night, I'm only going for a drink. Honestly believing that I really was really only going to have one drink, just one drink. And I did that continuously. And my husband would have to come get me, or we'd find my car on the front yard, or we'd go looking for my car, or, I mean, just tons and tons and tons of things. And I just didn't know at that point what alcohol was going to do to me. I didn't know if I was going to be your best friend and cry on your shoulder all night, or if I didn't know I was going to knock the hell out of you for something you had said to me. And it was very, very scary. Either way, I went. And I took a trip up the mountains. This is getting close to the end. And I drove in a blackout on the way home with both my children in the car. And when I got down and I woke up out of the blackout, I was very, very scared. I had this thing. My husband and I had a waterbed. And I'm almost embarrassed to tell this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. I had my husband convinced that it had a hole in it. And it was actually me. I had lost control of my bladder. I found myself sometimes in the closet using the restroom. It depended on if I mixed alcohol, where I was going to be, doing what. And it was very, very scary to me. And one night, my husband had been busily up helping some friends add on to their home. And he had been spending weeks and weeks up there on end building this tackle shed for our friend's home, and he promised he'd put planter boxes up at the front of our house. And so that night he came home and he was had a little bit too much to drink. I'm sorry. He invited me up there that night, and I saw this beautiful tackle shed, and I was a little bit pissed at him, so I decided not to drink because I was afraid I'd knock the hell out of him. So I came home, and when he came home, I insisted that he put the planter boxes on the front of the house. And he'd had too much to drink, and so I started to drink because I was pissed off at him, and I was damn sure I wasn't going to get those planter boxes in the front of my house, and this is the insanity of the alcohol, and it's thundering, and it's lightning, and he's got extension cords out on the front of the driveway, and it's thundering, and it's lightning, and I'm watching him at the front window just drinking and drinking, and I'm thinking, this is going to be good, you know. And so, I want to say about 11 o'clock midnight, he's finally finished with my planter boxes. And I go out there, and I look at him. I can't tell if I've had too much to drink or what the hell's wrong with the planter boxes. And I'm looking at him, and he's 20 sheets to the wind. And so I proceed to take him into the garage, and we get into a shoving match. And the window behind me breaks from something. I hit it somehow or kicked it with my back of my heel, and the window behind me breaks. We get in this huge screaming match, and we get in a huge shoving match, and a huge choking match, and it continues from one room to the other room to the other room, and it's completely out of control, and pretty soon the police are at our home. And the police are asking me if there's anything wrong, and so I show them the bruises on my arms, like the scratches and stuff on my arms. Yeah, there's something wrong. You know, this guy's pushing me and shoving me. And in all actuality, he was protecting himself. I'll give him that much credit because I was pissed off, and he was protecting himself. And so at that time, it was proposition, and I want to say it was 13, even though it's not the same cop now. You couldn't leave two domestic people in a fight at the same house. One had to go. He was drunk or he was gone. And as we're out, mind you, the whole neighborhood's watching. And as we're out in the driveway, taking my husband away, I turn around to go back in the house, and there's my six-year-old and my three-year-old watching. And their little heads are peeking off the little blinds. And they start crying, and their father's being driven away in a police car. Because our mother can't control herself. And I just looked at him, and I walked in the house, and I said, you know, where's my dad going? And I said, the police are taking him to a hotel. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, I put my kids to bed. I apologize, I'll go back a little. I put my kids to bed, and I go in the kitchen cabinet, and I pour out all the alcohol, because that's the only thing I know to do. I just start pulling out one bottle after another. And I don't know if I'm coming or going. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, I get a phone call. It's my husband. And he says, where am I? And I don't know what to say to him. I don't know. I'm pissed. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know what to tell him. And I say, well, you're not here with us. And I hang up. Because in my sick mind, it's still his fault that he's there and I'm here. It's still his fault that we got in that shoving match and that we had that much to drink. That's how sick I am. And that morning I wake up and I call his employer and I tell his employer that he's sick and that he won't be into work that day. My girlfriend comes down, the one that he built the beautiful shed for, whatever you want to call it, comes down and takes my kids to school and takes care of them, and she knows what's going on, and I just ask her to take care of my kids so I can do whatever I can do. And I get up and I go to the courthouse, and I go looking for my husband, and they don't have my husband. They're telling me my husband is not in jail. And so I go home, and I make some phone calls, and sure as shit, he is in jail. So they say, go back tomorrow, he'll be on a docket or something. So I go back the next day, and I go through the whole process, and they tell me my husband's not in jail. So meanwhile, I'm calling his employer and telling his employer that he's still sick. His employer wants to talk to him, but he's too sick to come to the phone.
No,
that's not horrendous. I just thought of another amend. And so this goes on for days and days and days. And about the fifth day, mind you, I have a district attorney who has told me now that I have to press charges. If I don't press charges, she's going to press charges anyway. So I let her press the charges. So now my husband's in huge trouble. the fifth day, I'm sitting there, and I'm at my wit's end, and my husband is finally on one of those sheets, and he's going to be showing up in this courtroom. And so I'm going to go there, and I'm sitting there, and I'm a mess, and I don't know what to do, and I don't know if I'm coming, and I don't know if I'm going, and I know that I can't drink, but I want to drink. And I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, you know, how am I going to get us out of this mess? And I'm nervous, and I'm rustling through my purse, and lo and behold, this little book is in my purse, and it's a little itty-bitty tiny prayer book, and the first page I open, it's a prayer, and it says, you put in the words, if, dear God, if you get me, da-da-da-da-da, I will do this. And so I kept saying, you know, dear God, if you get me out of trouble, I won't drink anymore. But I did that for about 4 hours, not believing it, but saying it over and over so I can make a promise to him again so I could get out of this mess. And so, you know, my husband finally was in front of the judge, and the judge opens a manila folder, and what falls out, I'm assuming, is his speeding ticket and nothing else. And the judge says to my husband, is there anybody here to pick you up? And he said, my wife. And he looks out into the courtroom, and he can't see me because I'm hiding behind a pillar. And so I look, and he looks. And she said, you know, the only advice I have to you folks is maybe you might want to try AA. And my heart just sinks. I think, oh my God, he doesn't even know us. And how does he know that? One smart judge, people, I'm telling you. He knew the Morrises. He lived with us. So anyway, we get in the car together. And my husband says to me, I'm driving, he says, you know, I sure could use a drink. And I said to him, that's fine, but I poured out all the alcohol. We don't have any alcohol in the house. I'm not going to be drinking. And he said, that's good stuff to get go. I could sure use a drink. And so I started crying. And I cried and I cried. And I said, I can't trust myself with alcohol. I can't have alcohol around me. And I didn't realize that that was the beginning of my journey when I said those words. And I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I was going to try to do it. And months went by, and I didn't drink. And one night, I had given up drinking, and one night I went out with some girls that were bunco friends, and we went back up to Wilsonia, and I wasn't going to drink. I was a driver, and it had been 3 months since I'd had any alcohol, and this whole episode had happened. And we were sitting there on the deck playing cards, and one of the girls said, well, Blue, you can just have a beer. And I thought, oh, yeah, I could just have a beer. You know, not a big deal. And so I just had a beer, woke up at 3 in the morning wondering how I was drunk again and how I had blacked out and how I was going to explain. I went to bed up at this cabin, and there was somebody sleeping in this bed with me that was one of my bunco friends who was just in the bed. Never mind. Anyway, and I was wondering how I did this again. Because I knew I was only going to have one beer. I said I was only going to have one beer. And so I swore off alcohol. And one of my sisters got into AA. She went to a treatment center. And when she came out of this treatment center, there was a change in her. There was something different about her. And I wasn't sure what it was, but she had a meaning and a purpose. And she had a big book, and she had a sponsor, and she was going to start working some steps. And I watched her, and I just thought, you know, she just looked different. She had a little different step in her, you know, and here I am, Miss Misery. I'm not drinking. I got 6 more months of sobriety. What the hell? She's so fucking happy, and that's bullshit. You know, I got more sobriety. Don't you see me? Don't you know I've done it? I've worked it harder. I've been doing this longer than her. And so one day my sister said, I'm going to take you someplace. I'm going to take you to a meeting with me. Okay, I can do this. I can go with her. I can do this. She took me out to this meeting out on Avenue 264. And there was a water balloon fight and a squirt gun fight that night. And they were having fun. And mind you, my sister never returned. I've been there ever since. But meetings new. My sister never returned because that was not her cup of tea, but that was my cup of tea. I liked it. They were having fun. the girl said she had 2 years. We were laughing because she spoke to Rayanne, and I knew damn good well she didn't have 2 years, but she was awfully cute. I was going to believe her that night. We got in the car, and I was a little bit miffed at my sister because people had gone around the rooms and kind of were talking about alcohol and their stories and different things. And I had known she'd gone before the meeting and called people and said, you know, you need to say this because my sister's coming to the meeting. And she was busy calling everybody in that room because everybody, someone had something to say that kind of resembled something I was going through or been through when I'd been drinking. And so I knew she'd set me up. And, you know, I returned once a week for quite some time. And I liked what they had to say. I did cry for the first 2 years in AA. I'm not proud of it, but it's what I did. I didn't know what feelings were. They were all over the place, and they were usually came out in tears, and that was okay. And, you know, I knew that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous had something that I wanted. I knew that that somehow they were going to take care of me, these perfect strangers, that people welcomed me at this end of this table, and that was a huge deal because the big wings sat at the end of this certain table at the Breath of Fresh Air, and they asked me to come sit with them. So I knew I'd had it made. I was in because I was sitting with them, and I knew that was important, and that was big. My sister let me borrow her sponsor, and I've had her for 11 years since, and I'm glad she let me borrow her. We're a perfect fit, I think. And what's most important that I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is my sister gave me a big book, and I actually had to open it up and use it. My sponsor not only made me work the steps, she made me work the traditions. I have homework. I like having homework and being busy. I don't do Alcoholics Anonymous perfect by any means, but today I do it the best that I can. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has, I lost a nephew in Alcoholics Anonymous who was murdered, and they got me through that. I lost a mom. They got me through that. And, I'm so grateful. I'm laughing, crying, sorry. I'm just very, very grateful because, it's just a wonderful place to be. Sorry. Alcoholics Anonymous is, has given me a life that I truly want, with friends that I truly want. They've helped me raise my kids, and I'm not good at that, but I'm okay. I've had the same job for a long, long time. My employer actually likes me some days. I don't miss work unless I'm really, really sick. You know, I do the best that I can with the tools that they've given me. And that's what's so important is the big book and the sponsor and the friendships are a huge portion. I'm grateful that they made me become secretary of the meeting. If you're new, make sure you get involved. I used to laugh because you used to have to pick up cigarette butts. Now you can't pick up cigarette butts anywhere because you can't smoke. You know, I have a father that has celebrated 38 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I wasn't coming here because of him. It was so much different, and I'm so grateful that he tread the path for me. My big thing, my big hoopla that I'm on right now is somebody really ruffled my feathers, and they said, you know, why do you still have to go to AA? And it really pissed me off to no avail because if the people in front of me weren't here, it wouldn't have been here for me, and I'll be God-danged if I'm not going to be here for the people that are coming behind me. I'm grateful what has been given so freely to me, and that's why I keep showing up. And I thank you guys for letting me share. I'm so bad. Does anybody have any questions? Go ahead. What is your name?
My name is Ray.
Hi, Ray. Yes, he's not an Alcoholics Anonymous. He just doesn't drink because we don't allow alcohol in our house. So he's miserable, and he doesn't know why he's miserable. I could tell him why he's miserable, but that wouldn't be fair. But no, my husband doesn't drink that I'm aware of. He could when he goes on his trips, but I don't know about it. Anyone else? Anybody else want to share? Anybody have anything to share? Anyone's got something going on in their life that they'd like to share about? I did. You know, I really believe that my favorite step is probably step one, that admitting every day and turning it over that my life is unmanageable and that I do have to turn it over every day and that I am powerless over people, places, and things because I'm a control freak. And every morning I have to remember that I am powerless. And so every day I have to turn it over, and that's huge for me. You want to share, Paige? Anybody else? Anybody else have a favorite step in life? You guys, you got 15 minutes. Amazing. You're welcome.
Ha ha ha.
welcome. Thank you for sharing. Sure, go. Oh, no. Okay, be in charge. Me personally?
I'm asking you.
Okay. Okay. You know, when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I grew up in the Catholic Church. So I was taught that if you lied, you were going to get beaten. Well, you were going to get in trouble. We used to have to do this thing at George McCann, which was face-to-face to a priest's confession. And when I grew up under the understanding that of a punishing God. And that's just the way I grew up. That's not what the church teaches you. It's just the way my family reiterated how it was going to be. And so when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew I was going to hell, but I was going to do the best that I could with these steps and these tools that you gave me. And that's all that was expected from me. That's all my sponsor expected from me. That's all you fellows expected, to do the best that I can and keep my side of the street clean. And Alcoholics Anonymous, through bits and pieces and people in AA, have taught me that my God can be anything I want. I got to make a list of what I wanted my God to be. I actually got enough backbone to go to a different church and feel my way around the community and churches. And, you know, my understanding of my God is, you know, there are some days that I'm really, really bad. But those days are the days that I learn the most. And those days are the days that I'm not ashamed to get on my hands and knees and ask for forgiveness, because that's all he expects of me every single day. If I want to be a pompous ass, then, you know, I probably won't end up with most of you people. But if I want to be a good, loving human being, the way God wants us to be on this earth, that Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me, is that I just keep my side of the street clean to the best of my ability, not your ability or your ability, my best ability. And you know what? It's okay. Every day, I'm okay. And every day, I get one more day to be okay. And that's fine with me.
Do you sponsor people?
I do.
Can you tell the sponsors anything different from what you sponsor people?
You know, I only sponsor people that I only try to teach them by my own personal experience. If it's out of my realm, you know, I have two children, and it's still out of my realm some days. I mean, you know, I haven't done the best with my children. I am not a counselor by any means. I'm just me. If it has to do with my sobriety and things that I've learned about, but I always, anything that needs to be outside issue needs to be an outside issue. I don't instruct anybody on medications that they're taking. Well, that's not true. True, huh? I work for a physician, so sometimes I do. I'm going to be honest, I might as well be honest. But psychotropic drugs, I don't, that's somebody else's, you know, if I'm going to need something, if my brain is imbalanced and I need something, that's between me and my doctor. It's not between me and my sponsees. I may talk to my sponsor about it, but I don't share information that I'm not supposed to share information. I just do the best that I can. Good answer?
How long do you think a person should spend on step four?
As long as it takes them? Good answer?
Wrong.
Why is that wrong? You know what? I think your sponsor can help you along with that. My big thing is, you know, I had to write a novel, and my sponsor said, hey, boo, slow down. I mean, you just need to make it simple, keep it simple, because there are no novels needed here. So as long as it takes a person, as long as your sponsor, you know, your sponsor should know. I mean, it shouldn't take me 2 years. It shouldn't be that stagnant. Okay, next question.
I'm doing good now.
My sponsor gave me 1 week to do step four.
Oh.
And at the end of it, all the people had on there, so now we're going to go to step eight. So what? So you're going to make amends to all those people. I said, don't make the wrong leaves. I said, leave that.
Yeah.
And then he made me come back. I believe that we have a little bit of sobriety. When we start to sponsor people, we don't get too far away from the people that sponsored us. That's why we keep going back to, you know, your grand sponsor, this sponsor, that, you know, on. My original sponsor, I've had him for 34 years. And he's still alive. I don't just want to go. Every time I call him up, first thing he wants to know is what's that I'm working on. And I ask him, why do you always ask me that? So that way I know where you're at when you go on from there. I don't care what I'm talking about. The first thing he wants to know. When people that I sponsor call me, I want to know where they're at. And it's easier for me, if they say no, all kinds of crap going on, I don't need to hear that. Because I can't solve it. I can only give guidance.